Listen to that. Do you hear crickets? It's a sound coming from the tall grasses and the wildflowers growing up alongside my bike path as I make my way in before dawn. We're appreciating the insect world and why the loss of insect life is very troubling here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Insects have been around the block, so to speak. They have survived four of the Earth's five mass extinctions to date, including the one that wiped out the dinosaurs. British biologist Dave Goulson points out that they were ancient when the first dinosaurs appeared. What do you think the world would be like without insects? Are you a farmer who relies on pollinators? Have you had to hire beekeepers to pollinate your crops? It's 800-642-1234. Dave Goulson is a biology professor specializing in bee ecology at the University of Sussex. His new book is called Silent Earth, Averting the Insect Apocalypse. Dave, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Morning, Kate. It's a pleasure to be here.
Good morning to you. You know, we're going to start in the future. You tell us this chilling, foreboding story from the future when climate change becomes unstoppable, when, you know, the final Amazon rainforest is no longer with us. What is this world you speak of?
Yeah, I try to, in one chapter in the book, I try to imagine, you know, what the world will be like when my son is my age and older.
80.
And what he's like. I'm only 56 at the moment. And I mean, there really are this whole cascade of interrelated environmental disasters that I don't want to sound too doom and gloom, but that if we're not careful, will unravel. And the danger is that we're going to leave future generations with a much lower standard of living, far fewer resources. Life's going to be tough unless we turn it around, unless we act more responsibly. So I imagine my son kind of guarding the vegetable patch in a sort of slightly post-apocalyptic world. Mm. And I explain how that might come about over the coming decades if we don't, basically get our act together.
Your beloved bees are gone in this world, you know, killed off by pesticides and the like. And people are hand pollinating crops, which actually isn't that far-fetched. Is that right?
Well, it's already happening in some parts of the world. Yeah. It's the first place it started was in southwest China, where they have big areas of apple and pear orchards. And now for I think it's about 20 years, they've been hand pollinating because there just aren't anywhere near enough natural pollinators left. And I've seen it myself more recently in Bengal in India. And there are reports of it from parts of Brazil. So it's spreading. And, you know, we that should really make us sit up and take note, because, you know, we can't hand pollinate all the rest of the world's crops. There just aren't enough people. And bees are really good at it. You know, it's kind of crazy that we wouldn't look after them better.
I would imagine we should be saying that's really alarming, because this is hard work and we have bees do all this work. I mean, it's actually putting us in their shoes for a moment.
Yeah, bees have been pollinating plants for about 120 million years. They're really, really good at it. They've evolved all sorts of behaviors and features. You know, their body is adapted to flying efficiently, to gathering pollen. They have special baskets on their legs. They have a special honey stomach for storing the nectar. Basically, they are masters at visiting flowers. It isn't just bees, I should say. Actually, they're helped out by wasps and beetles and flies and all sorts of other insects too. But between them, they ensure that wildflowers set seed, and that 3/4 of our crops produce a good harvest.
We're talking with Dave Goulson, who's a biology professor specializing in bee ecology at the University of Sussex. His new book is called Silent Earth. You can join in. What is your relationship to insects? What is it about them that fascinates you or maybe disgusts you? Have you seen the benefits of some insects in your garden or home? Join in 800-642-1234. You know, you write that insects make up the bulk of known species of our world. Can you put that into perspective for us? Give us some context of how many insect species are out there.
Yeah, so far we have named about 1.5 million species of animal and plant in total on our planet, of which 1.1 million are different types of insects. So, that's well over 2/3 of all known species are insect. But the thing that I think I find most sort of astounding is that it's estimated that there are maybe 3, 4, 5 million more insect species that we haven't even named yet, that we don't know exist. And there new ones are described every day. We've yet to even give a name to the bulk of biodiversity that we share our planet with.
Why have entomologists and other scientists only identified like 1 in 5 insect species? Are you
Yeah,
falling down on
it
the
makes,
job? Come on.
I'm making us all sound very lazy, aren't I? But it's, actually, the thing is, the more species are named, the harder it is to find a new one, because not because they're not easy to catch. If you were to go to a tropical rainforest with a net and swipe it around, you'd probably catch new species by the dozen. But having the expertise to know that it's not one of the 1.1 million species we've already named is takes years and years and years of training. It's a really specialist job, and there aren't actually that many jobs in insect taxonomy. It's not something that gets a lot of funding these days. So that's basically why we have yet to catalogue most of life on Earth.
Oh, you're understaffed and underspecialized, it sounds like. I mean, it's really neat. This book reminds me of like a love letter to insects, and you've been so passionate about insects since you caught your first caterpillar at age 5. But some people are really repulsed by insects. What do you make of that?
Yeah, obviously, personally, I find it's hard to understand because I've always been fascinated by insects. I mean, they're amazing creatures, not just important for what they do for us, but just intriguing and fascinating. And so my mission in life is to try and win people over, to try and persuade them to love insects. Or, if that's a bit too much for many people, to at least respect insects, both because they're important to us and to ecosystems, but also just for their own sake. I kind of think we shouldn't just justify conserving insects and other wildlife because of things they do for us. That's a very It's quite a selfish way of viewing things. I would argue that whether or not they do anything useful, they deserve a place on our planet just as much as we do. And actually, most insects have been here much longer than us. And
Yeah, in the seas. Can you take us through that? Like insects coming up through the seas, half a billion years ago, making it onto dry land and making a life for themselves.
Yeah, so I mean the ancestors of insects crawled out of the oceans about 390 million years ago, which is just an unimaginable length of time. The human brain can't deal with numbers like that. And but it's long, long before there were any dinosaurs. Insects were among the first creatures on land. And they became enormously successful. They more or less had the land to themselves, aside from a few spiders and millipedes and other creepy crawlies, as you might call them. They were the first creatures to evolve flight, and so that was about 380 million years ago. They were the first creatures to sing, to make the first noises made by animals on our planet were probably grasshoppers chirping or something like that. We obviously don't know for sure. And they proliferated to the millions and millions of species that we see today. And as you mentioned in the introduction, they've made it through a whole succession of mass extinction events that wiped out many other organisms. But the insects have continued until very recently to be the dominant life form on land. Imagine an alien peering down at Earth any time in Earth's history. Well, until the last 200 years, they would have thought this was the planet of the insects.
University of Sussex biology professor Dave Goulson, he writes that his mission in life is to persuade people like you to love insects, or at least to respect them for all that they do. Do you love or hate bugs? What is it about them that fascinates you? Have you had a run-in with fire ants like me, biting and stinging all at once? What was that like? What insects have you you know, have your utmost respect. Join in at any point, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute for more on insects here on the Ideas Network. What could be driving the global disappearance of insects, and why is it most concerning to the entomologists on the case? We're talking about the challenges to the insect world on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Biologist Dave Goulson, he wants us to see insects as he does, as beautiful, surprising, sometimes surpassingly strange, sometimes sinister and disturbing, but always marvelous and deserving of our esteem. Is this the view, your view of insects? Have you been fascinated with bees or butterflies, maybe fireflies, since you were a kid? What are your earliest memories? 800-642-1234. Dave Goulson's book is called Silent Earth, and he's with us for the hour. You know, Dave, I just really appreciate your charming capsules, your short vignettes of all these different insects. And they're really short and sweet, sometimes not really sweet, but always really amazing. And I want you to introduce us to the leafcutter ants and take us into the lives of leafcutter ants, just as a for instance.
Yeah, sure. Our leafcutter ants, social insects, they live in these incredible, enormous colonies that may have 4 million or more ants, all working for the queen, essentially, who lays the eggs. And they have a network of underground chambers they live in. And part of their biology that's really weird and wonderful is they eat leaves, or at least they appear to eat leaves. They're called leafcutter ants because the workers go out in the day and they take snippets of leaf from, they climb up trees and then carry the snippets of leaf that they cut back to their nest. But actually they can't eat leaves. What they do is they have a special fungus garden underground in a chamber, and they chew up the leaves into a kind of pulp and then feed it to a fungus. And it's a species of fungus that only lives in leafcutter ant nests, can't survive without the ants. And they're essentially, it's like a garden underground. And the fungus produces little sort of fruiting bodies, little round blobby spores, which is actually what the ants use for food. And they have this extraordinary organization of their society with different individuals doing different jobs. There are soldiers that have huge heads with big jaws that guard the nest, and tiny little ants that tend to the queen and the fungus garden and so on. The whole thing is just a world in itself. It's sometimes called, described, the nest is described as a superorganism, because essentially the 4 million ants kind of in a way act as if they're one organism.
Wow. And everyone knows their role. It's so orderly. You know, you also mentioned there's an estimate that there are between 1 in 10 quadrillion individual ants in the world. How could you even make an estimate?
I should say I didn't make that calculation. I leave that to the ant experts. There are people like E.O. Wilson, who's an American biologist who spent their whole lives studying ants, and there's so much to study about ants. They really are fascinating creatures. But yeah, those figures are quite back of an envelope. The honest truth is, of course, you know, we don't, it's not possible to do anything more than roughly guess how many ants are out there. But basically, so far as we know, there are roughly the same weight of ants in the world as there are people. So they outnumber us at least 1 million to 1, probably more.
Wow. You know, you just can't make this stuff up. You said in Madagascar, there lives a moth which sucks salty tears from underneath the eyelids of sleeping birds. And there's a shield bug from Thailand that bears an uncanny resemblance to Elvis.
It really does. You've got to see it to believe it.
This is just amazing. It's no wonder.
Google it if you don't believe me.
It's no wonder that you really appreciate all the uniqueness that this whole insect world offers. There's always something new.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's more than enough to keep me occupied for my lifetime and hundreds of lifetimes beyond. You know, there's so much to discover. Insects, you know, they do have all sorts of peculiar life cycles and behaviors, and everyone is different. And as I said earlier, you know, there are millions of them we haven't even named yet, let alone begun to scratch the surface of what they do, how they behave, you know, what their life cycle
Well,
with business and so on. So there's tons, yeah.
let's look at the threats and what are the real challenges here to insects. And we're going to get to the chemicals, but I want to start with light pollution, because in our cities, we see so much light. Why are so many insects drawn to light, first of all?
Yeah, that is a slight mystery, actually, which I've written about in the past, but we don't honestly know. It makes little sense that moths, in particular, of course, are attracted to light, and it's been suggested that the light is it's they think it's the moon, but then moths don't try to fly to the moon, so it can't be as simple as that. It's the more sensible explanation is that they're perhaps trying to navigate by using the moon as a fixed point. And if you fly at an angle to the moon, then you'll fly in an approximately straight line. But if you try to fly at an angle to a light, which is obviously much closer to you than the moon, then actually you end up flying in a circle, an ever decreasing circle around the light. And maybe that's what's going on. We honestly don't know, but the practical outcome of it is that, millions of insects bash themselves to death on lights every night. And they're if they don't just bash themselves to death, they're easily picked off by spiders and bats and other creatures. But also light pollution has more subtle effects on insects. So for example, it was recently discovered that it can interfere with their perception of what time of year it is, because lots of insects time their life cycle according to day length. But if there's artificial light at night, then they might emerge from hibernation in the middle of January thinking it's spring, and of course that would then be immediately killed by the first frost. And there's even a really interesting example of dung beetles. Some dung beetles roll balls of dung and push them along and bury them. And they use the light of the Milky Way as a compass so that they can maintain a straight line. But if there's light pollution, they can't detect the Milky Way, just as we can't. And so they get lost and go around in circles, poor things. So I don't know why I'm laughing. It's kind of sad, but also fascinating. But yeah, so obviously the fact that light pollution is getting worse every year globally, we have more and more lights through the night, is a worrying development for insects.
We're talking with Dave Goulson this hour, author of Silent Earth, as we learn why insects are becoming more scarce, why our world can't function without them. With your questions along the way at 800-642-1234. Dave, the threat of pesticides, of herbicides, of these chemicals that are trying to control insects on crops. One of the most famous from our past is DDT, which has been banned. Can you kind of give us some contrast comparisons with DDT as you now see what modern pesticides offer and are made of?
I mean, it's hard to know where to start, actually. This is a complicated business, but essentially pesticides came in after the Second World War. DDT and organophosphates were the two main types. And they were very successful at reducing pest problems for a while, and farmers adopted them with great enthusiasm because none of us were, at the time, were aware of the downsides. But of course, in Rachel Carson in 1962 highlighted all the environmental harm that actually they were causing, and eventually those chemicals were largely banned. But in the meantime, we've developed and invented hundreds of more different types of pesticides, and some of them are much more poisonous than DDT, for example. So there's a class of insecticides called neonicotinoid insecticides, which are kind of synthetic versions of nicotine. And they're about 7,000 times more poisonous to a honeybee, for example, than DDT ever was. And we're using pesticides ever more. For example, today we globally apply about 4 million tons of pesticide to the landscape every year, which is a figure that's doubled since 1990. So it's a problem that's steadily getting worse. And if you're an insect trying to survive in modern farmland, you're going to have to cope with being exposed to a constant barrage, a blizzard of pesticides. Little wonder that farmland is mostly fairly hostile to life.
Yeah, certainly, like Roundup, notorious herbicides, very widely used. That has, I would imagine, having a huge impact.
Yeah, I mean, herbicides are an interesting one because you wouldn't, I think, that necessarily a herbicide would be directly harmful to insects. It's not designed to kill insects. But Roundup in particular, the active ingredient glyphosate, has become notorious for a number of reasons. One is that it's been linked to cancer in humans. But also it turns out that it's toxic to bees. It knocks out their gut microbes, which help them to resist disease, and so that makes them more prone to infection.
Let's pause there with Dave Goulson, biologist at the University of Sussex. We'll be back in a moment. Stay with us. More on insects after this news update on the Ideas Network. Of the 1 million insects named so far, most have not been studied at all, according to biology professor and author Dave Goulson. So who knows what fascinating discoveries remain to be made with regard to their lives? We're learning about these knowledge gaps, right, and the disturbing decline of insects here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Their declines are a sign, Goulson writes, that the fragile web of life on our planet is beginning to tear apart. Do you participate in butterfly counts, maybe other projects, as a citizen scientist? What do you want to know about a bug that's always fascinated you? How are you making your yard or garden a haven for pollinators? Be part of this hour, 800-642-1234. Dave Goulson's book is called Silent Earth. He's with us for the hour. Dave, we're talking about neonicotinoids and these chemicals put on cropland, pesticides. They end up in the soil, right? Soil and water. What happens when they build up and are used repeatedly?
Well, so just to focus on those neonicotinoids that you mentioned, we know they're quite persistent when they get into the ground, so they can last for years, which means if a farmer's using them year on year, they'll accumulate. And we also know that they're systemic pesticides, which means that they're meant to spread through the tissues of the crop and protect it against insects eating the crop, which sounds good from a farmer's perspective, but they're also taken up by wildflowers and hedgerow plants and trees and any other vegetation in the landscape that has its roots in the contaminated soil. And then the wildflowers become poisonous. The nectar of the wildflowers becomes poisonous to bees. And as you mentioned, they also leach into the water and turn up in streams where they clearly not going to help aquatic insects to thrive. So unfortunately, we've sort of polluted the whole landscape with these mixtures of different pesticides. And inevitably, is having quite profound impacts on biodiversity generally.
What is actually the consensus right now about why insects are in decline and to what extent they are in decline?
There's no doubt that they are in decline. The exact rate is hard to calculate because, as we discussed, we haven't even named most of them. Many insects we have no data for at all, but the ones that are being counted are clearly declining. So, for example, in the UK, we have a really detailed monitoring system for butterflies. And since I was 11 years old in 1976, their population has roughly halved. We know that, for example, in North America, monarch butterflies are down actually about 80% since the 1990s. But for each insect, the causes of decline may be slightly different. There's certainly not one single cause. It's undoubtedly a kind of combination of habitat loss, which continues as rainforests are cut down and so on, the spread of intensive farming, the associated pesticides and fertilizers, light pollution, climate change, invasive species. There's a whole bunch of problems, all of them, of course, at the end of the day, down to us. And so, really, it's down to us to fix them.
Let's bring in a call now. Ross is joining us from Middleton. Hi, Ross. What is on your mind about insects?
Yeah, hi, good morning. Here in Wisconsin, the temperatures are gradually getting cooler, and it seems like the insect population is kind of simmering down. There's a few of them that are still flying around. Yesterday, I saw a praying mantis. Turns out it's not a native. It's a non-native praying mantis. But nevertheless, it was kind of interesting to see this big insect flying around. The question that I have is that a lot of what we see with the decline of insects has to do with the way that we eat and the food that we eat. So I try to buy organic food to sort of the idea is that we're promoting less use of chemicals. I was wondering if the guest could speak a little bit more. Is there any cutting edge research as to, from an insect biologist point of view, as to ways to protect these plants that we eat from insects that are maybe would be in a more sustainable way of doing it?
Ross, thank you. Dave, go ahead.
Yeah, sure. I absolutely. At the end of the day, the farming is to produce food for us, and the food we choose to buy drives the whole system. So if more people bought organic food, there would be fewer pesticides used, for example. And more than that, I think we can help by growing locally grown, seasonally produced food rather than food that's been flown in from thousands of miles away. And trying to kind of reconnect people with where food comes from and making them or trying to encourage people to appreciate the qualities of, locally grown fruit and veg rather than heavily processed food would really help. There are lots of alternatives. I think many people just sort of accepted industrial agriculture as necessary to produce enough food to feed everybody. But actually, 70% of the world's food is produced by small farms under 2 hectares in size. And you could argue that the kind of industrial approach to farming is doing more harm than good, and that because it's wiping out biodiversity, it damages the soil, it contributes a lot to climate change. And I don't think it's really sustainable in the long term. So we do need to investigate alternatives, and there's some really interesting ideas out there, things like agroforestry, organic, permaculture, biodynamic farming, all of them really focused essentially on working with nature rather than sort of trying to control and kill everything, which to me seems like an appealing approach.
Can you speak to the waste as well? That statistic that we grow 3 times as many calories as we need to feed the human population.
Yeah, I mean, it's nuts, really. We do all this intensive farming at great cost to the environment. And then we throw away globally about a third of the food that we produce just goes to waste. And then another third roughly gets fed to livestock. Many animals these days are reared indoors or in feedlots in pretty crowded conditions, and that's where a lot of the crops that are grown that's where they go, which isn't at the end of the day a terribly efficient way of feeding people. So there's enormous waste in the system, and it's very simplistic and easy to say and hard to do, but just suppose we could, for example, halve food waste. That means that a sixth of all the farmland in the world could be freed from farming, could be turned into a giant nature reserve or whatever you'd like, which that sounds pretty fantastic to me.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Dave Goulson, who is a biology professor specializing in bee ecology at the University of Sussex, as we learn why insects are essential to our survival. Let's take another call now. Mark in Bowler. Hi, Mark. What is on your mind about bugs?
Good morning. Because we are a mobile society and we use our vehicles on daily use, has any thought been given to the millions of insects which fly at the same level our vehicles are traveling? I mean, we've all looked at our vehicles after a trip and peppered with the carcasses of the poorer critters.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And certainly, Dave, you've looked at this as well over the years in terms of from a research perspective.
Yeah, there have been a number of attempts to quantify the bug splats on windshields, and there are many people that have noticed there are far fewer than there used to be. Certainly in Europe, that's a very common perception, and it seems to be real. There have been some sort of academic studies, some that I've been involved in, and undoubtedly there are fewer bug splats on windshields now than there were even just 20 years ago. Whether the traffic collisions are a really significant contributor to insect declines, I doubt. I think in the grand scheme of things, of course they don't help. But probably the actual numbers of insects that die at the hands of cars are small compared to those killed when, for example, a farmer goes out and sprays a field with insecticide.
Can we pause here for just a little bit of a moment of a bug celebration? And let's perhaps maybe not celebration, but looking at locusts and what happens when their population swells to hundreds of billions. How does that happen?
It happens when the conditions are right for them to multiply. Locusts are really interesting creatures in that they have kind of two forms. So for most of the time, for years on end, many generations, they live quietly. They're green, relatively sedentary. They don't move around very much. But if you get heavy rains, which produce a big flush of fresh vegetation, which stimulates the population to start growing. As soon as they start bumping into each other a lot, they switch into a gregarious form where they actively congregate together and they change color. They become much more brightly colored, yellows and blacks. And they form these giant swarms which denude the landscape. And you know, when they've eaten everything, they then take to the air and it can be absolutely devastating for crops. You know, much as I love insects, I have to concede that there are times and places where they're really problematic for us humans.
Yeah, and you said that, you know, they may be able to avoid the looming insect apocalypse. What do you mean by that?
Well, so there's no doubt at all that some insects will be around for a very long time. You know, when people talk about the insect apocalypse, they're not talking about realistically the extermination of all insects. They're talking about the disappearance of many insects, including perhaps the more important ones from our perspective, bees and butterflies and so on. But things like cockroaches and house flies and probably locusts, I suspect will be here long after we're gone. They're quite adaptable creatures, and they're lucky in that they, particularly things like flies, they thrive in conditions that we provide. You know, house flies love human waste, all the sort of organic waste, the food waste that we throw away, for example. They will, you know, and they're also quite adaptable. They've developed resistance to pesticides and so on. So I suspect we don't need to worry about all insects. They will almost certainly outlive us, I suspect.
Biologist Dave Goulson says insects have declined in abundance by 75% or more since he was 5 years old. It's been 50 years since he first collected caterpillars in his school playground. Have you collected caterpillars before? Have you created a butterfly garden? Are you familiar with the Weebie app from the UW to record the activity of bees and other pollinators? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Dave Goulson here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Biologist Dave Goulson gives us 70 bullet points. I counted them. 70 bullet points in all, developed a list of actions all of us can take to create a society that values the natural world. And he writes, imagine green cities filled with trees, vegetable gardens, ponds, and wildflowers squeezed into every available space, all free from pesticides. Dave Goulson's book is called Silent Earth. He's with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's go to Russ now in Stoughton. Hi, Russ. What's on your mind?
Hi, good morning. I'm almost 75. I've been collecting bugs and and all of that since I was probably 5 or 6 and enjoying them. And for the most part, we used to see and play with what I don't know their scientific name, but we call them daddy long leg spiders. And they would be all over screens in our cabins and I crawl across our hands. And I read not too many years ago that daddy long leg spiders are actually poisonous, but have no way to deliver their poison. So I was wondering, why would Mother Nature give an insect, a bug, poison, but no way to deliver it?
Russ, thank you. Dave.
So the amounts of poison that these little spiders can produce are just so small that they're no threat to us, and their mouth parts aren't designed to penetrate human skin. So even if they wanted to bite you, they're completely incapable of it. But they're not adapted to try it. They don't want to kill humans, obviously. That we're not their prey. They can use their mouth parts to bite small insects that they've caught in their web, and that's what the venom is intended to poison. They're absolutely no threat whatsoever to us, but theoretically they are poisonous.
Oh, they're so wonderful to watch too, just those legs and how they move about.
Yeah, they're not everyone's favorite, are they? There's something about insects which unfortunately inspires revulsion in many people. And I think the longer the legs, the less people like them, sadly.
Russ, thanks. Let's go to Chris in Manitowoc. Hi, Chris. What is your question?
Hi. Hello. We spend a lot of time, many, many years, developing gardens around our homes so that we have more insects and, of course, birds and butterflies and bees and all those types of things. And there's been a proliferation in our neighborhood and everywhere that I can see because of this year we've had a really bad mosquito population of people having services come in and spray for mosquitoes. And, you know, that fog that's developed when they're spraying, I'm really concerned about it impacting our yard. And I'm just wondering, you know, how that might affect local ecosystems when they're spraying for mosquitoes.
Yeah. How does that spray carry, Dave?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it depends a little bit exactly what's being sprayed, but that fogging process is pretty indiscriminate, clearly. You know, if you're blasting a cloud of fine droplets of insecticide into a yard, it will drift on the wind and may go for hundreds of yards or more. And it depresses me, I must admit, this practice. Because it will kill all insects. It will kill the monarch butterflies that are passing through. It will kill any bees that are foolish enough to fly. You know, it seems an incredibly heavy-handed approach to trying to control one insect species, to kill literally thousands of species in the process. I think there are better ways.
Yeah, let's get to those better ways. Help us with some pointers on what we can do at the individual level to help insects thrive.
Well, there's lots we can do. And this is actually, listeners might have been getting a bit depressed, all this talk of pesticides and insect declines and everything. And a lot of environmental issues, you know, people do feel helpless about. But the good thing about the story of insect declines is that we can all get involved directly ourselves and do stuff that will really help them and see the results quite quickly. You know, if you make your yard insect friendly, you don't use any pesticides, you plant it full of bee friendly flowers, include some native wildflowers. If you've got a lawn, don't mow it so much, allow it to grow a bit longer and you'll get grasshoppers. And if you're lucky, the flowers will start to appear. Dig a little pond. Ponds are amazing for insect life. Perhaps put up a bee hotel, and lots of little things, and in no time at all, your garden will be teeming with life.
Explain what you mean.
Sorry,
by a bee hotel. Give us some visuals.
Sorry, yeah, I assume people know what these things are, but of course, most people. It's my own little world. So, a bee hotel is intended to provide a home for solitary bees. So, most people think of bees as social creatures that live in a hive, but actually the majority of bee species live on their own. A female bee makes her own little nest and quite a few species that can be found in gardens like to nest in horizontal holes. They probably naturally nest in a hole made by a beetle in a tree trunk. And so you can buy or make very easily bee hotels, which are basically, they might be a bundle of bamboo stems chopped up or a block of wood with lots of holes drilled in it. Put them on a sunny wall or fence, and with a bit of luck, you'll see these little bees appear in the spring and fill up the holes. They fill them with pollen and they lay their eggs and they seal the holes up often with mud at the end. So you'll see the holes start to fill up. And it's really fascinating to watch these little bees going about their business. You can even buy bee hotels with little windows on the side so that you can look what's happening inside, which certainly my kids always found really, really fascinating.
But butterfly hotels don't have the same vacancy rates, I would imagine.
No, there's a lot. There's some pretty dodgy products on the market, I have to say. Some of them are a bit of a waste of money. Probably quite good as spider or woodlouse hotels, but not for butterflies.
Let's go to Jackie in Milwaukee. Jackie, hi, what's on your mind?
Hi, I'm really interested in this subject. I don't use any pesticides. I plant flowers for bees and butterflies, but the squirrels just destroy them. Every time I plant them, they just destroy more rabbits. I'm not quite sure. But what I was curious about is if the guest has ever heard, there was an article, I think it was in Microwave News? It was something like that, Microwave Direct. And it talked about electromagnetic fields causing problems for flora and fauna. And it talked about migratory, like birds and bees. So I'm wondering how much that has to do with it, because they talked about how it's gone up 7,000% in over the last couple of years. And so the latest research is really kind of interesting. And, you know,
And Jackie, we're short on time, so I want to get Dave to jump in here.
Yeah, so it is a bit of a concern. There is certainly evidence that some insects can detect these electromagnetic fields. Certainly some insects use the Earth's electromagnetic field as a compass, and it's conceivable that they may be confused by our wavelengths that might therefore, you know, cause them to get lost when migrating and so on. Been very little research done on this, and the evidence is far from clear, but it's something that we probably should look into.
As we wrap up here in our last seconds left, are you hopeful that humans will find a way to save and to learn and to coexist with insects?
I really hope so. Catch me on a good day. Let's call it a good day today, and I'll say yes. You know, we could. We just need to turn it around. We need to tread more gently on a planet. You know, we live in this amazing world that it's our home, it's everything for us. You know, there is no planet B, and we really need to look after the one we've got. And what better place to start than by looking after the insects?
Oh, Dave, thank you for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
Dave Goulson, biology professor specializing in bee ecology at the University of Sussex. He is the author of the new book, Silent Earth, Averting the Insect Apocalypse. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.